Hi, this is Nona Jaquilla, and I'm here this morning with John Reppert, and we're going to be talking about several things, and I know that you wanted to start with your life as a journalist.
Yes. I thought I would spend my whole life as a journalist. My father was a newspaper editor, his brother was a newspaper editor, and we had a family newspaper, so I thought that's no big decision to be made. And I had anticipated doing that, so I studied journalism. I went to Kansas State University, where my father and my uncle had both gone. And the only odd thing about it is I started rather early. My father died when I was 10 years old. And so my uncle said, "Are you going to keep the newspaper?" I said, "Yes, of course."
Yeah.
He said, "Fine, if you're going to be the editor, you need to go to Kansas State. That's where your father and I went." So he threw me in the car that day, and we drove from southern Illinois, where I was living, out to Kansas State University and said, "We're meeting with the head of the journalism department."
And you were 10?
I was 10.
Wow.
So we went out there, and we had about a 40-minute interview with him.
Uh-huh.
And since I did know some things about journalism and had been involved, he said, "All right, I accept you."
Wow.
And I thought, a little early, but okay.
Yeah.
And I just thought, since he knew my father and my uncle, he was being polite to me. So when I was a senior in high school, I wrote him a letter and sent an application to be admitted.
Uh-huh.
He sent it back 3 days later. Said, "John, we did this years ago. You've been admitted since you were 10.
That's amazing.
I thought it was, too. Anyway, so I went out there and went through the School of Journalism and did the things that you typically do in that kind of thing. I was a reporter on the daily newspaper on campus, and then I was the editor of the daily newspaper. And then it happened to be our 200th anniversary of Kansas State University. And I said, "We want to put out a special yearbook. Will you stay and edit the yearbook?"
Oh, wonderful.
For us, so I got to edit a rather huge and heavy yearbook for it. Then I returned to my home in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
that my mother had been keeping as the editor in my absence, and started eagerly being the editor of our local, it's called the Gazette Democrat. And that worked fine for just over a year.
Mm-hmm.
My mother said, "I really like being the editor. Can you find something else to do?" So I created a new newspaper in a town about 20 miles away. Had to buy the building, had to recruit a staff, had to do a lot of the linotype and the other work myself.
Uh-huh.
But since I had been raised in that, I thought that would be fine. And we were doing just fine until the second phase of my life came, and that was I got a postcard from the Department of the Army. It said, "Congratulations, you are now private in the U.S. Army." And I said, "I've got a business, I've got all kinds of obligations." I said, "Doesn't matter to us.
Yeah.
You're now private in the U.S. Army." So I ran off to be a private in the U.S. Army. Not happily, but I said, "Well, if it has to be done, it has to be done." And started out in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and then went to officer candidate school for mm-hmm. 6 months, and they commissioned me a second lieutenant and sent me out to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, that I had never heard of, but it was a nice place. And I got there, and the colonel that I was assigned to said, "Well, I've got a strange job for you, but I hope you can do it." I said, "What's that?" They said, "We want you to be the editor of our Post newspaper." I said, "I can handle that."
Yeah.
So my first job in the Army was what I'd been doing for years, and I was the editor of their local newspaper.
What year was that?
That I was the editor of the Post newspaper at Fort Huachuca would have been 68, I'm guessing. No, she says...
68. That was when you got drafted. So
69.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been the editor of the Post newspaper out there, and enjoyed doing that. Unfortunately, in that time period, there was something else going on. It was called Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so after I had been there for a year, I received another invitation from the Army. It said, you're going to Vietnam. I said, okay. And so I finished all my preparation. I was married.
Mm-hmm.
Gave my wife a job teaching in school, which she had been trained to do. And then went off to California, where they packed us all up and shipped us off to Vietnam.
Were you nervous leaving your wife behind?
I was nervous leaving me behind without her.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, it worked out just fine, except two things. One is when I got out there, they said, we're going to send you to Saigon on there. And I said, I was a signal officer, is what they called it, telecommunications.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out there and they said, what's your background as a signal officer? I said, I just got my commission. I don't have any background as a signal officer. They said, all right, let me tell you what your job's going to be. We're short-handed a little bit. I'm giving you three different jobs. I said, all right. Said, the first one is you will run all the communications for General Westmoreland's headquarters. He's the commander of all forces in Vietnam. I said, that sounds pretty big. And the second job is you will be responsible for all communications at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon.
Wow.
And the third job is that there is a CIA office in Vietnam, and you'll be in charge of all their communications. I thought, I'm a second lieutenant. This is my first job. This sounds a little big, but okay.
Yeah.
So I went off, and that's what I did.
How did you manage all three big responsibilities at once?
I had good non-commissioned officers who had had much more experience than I did. I relied on them, and I talked with them frequently and would brief them on things I did before I did them, and was lucky in part.
Yeah.
But that was fine when they told me my three jobs. What they didn't tell me is that 2 months later, the Tet Offensive was going to begin.
Oh.
Saigon was not a war zone when I was initially assigned to it. Shortly after that, it became the war zone. I could tell the difference because when I woke up in my barracks in the morning, instead of the sound of music and people talking, there were machine guns firing mm-hmm. at us. So I ran out to my Jeep. As a second lieutenant, you don't get a driver.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran to my Jeep and hopped in and took off for the 2.5 miles to get to General Westmoreland's headquarters. I figured that's where I better start out.
Mm-hmm.
And all along the way, it was different because there were people shooting at me. And that hadn't happened on previous days going out there to work. But anyway, I got out there safely, and my troops were even more frightened than I was in the building because we didn't even normally have guns with us
mm-hmm.
at this. But I went in there and they were saying, sir, sir, they're shooting at us. I said, well, my memory served me well, and I said, remember the famous words of Winston Churchill at the beginning of World War II. I said, what was that? They ran out to him and said, sir, they're shooting at us in here. He said, that's okay. They're missing. We have nothing to worry about. Oh, they're missing.
Yeah.
So I said that, and troops, calm down. And we had a fairly good time after that. None of my people at any of the three sites were killed. One was wounded.
That's very
lucky.
At that
time. And he was wounded in a very strange way. The only way to get out of the embassy was off the roof at the time. So they sent in helicopters and said, grab the skids.
Mm-hmm.
He grabbed one of the skids, but he got shot in the leg while he was swinging on the skid. And so, but he recovered too. So that was my introduction to combat in Vietnam.
Yeah.
At a time that we thought that we had it pretty well stabilized. But turned out it wasn't as stable as it needed to be. But I ended up not only with the three sites, General Westmoreland's headquarters, the CIA, and the American Embassy, but in my first job, I had 150 enlisted people working for me.
Yeah.
I'd never had enlisted people work for me before, but scooting between those three sites for the rest of the time kept it all going. All of them went home safely, except the boy with a hole in his leg.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't seem to be bothered that much. And that was my introduction to the Army and to Vietnam at the time. In the meantime, of course, my mother had taken over the newspaper again. Said, don't hurry back, I enjoy running this newspaper. And so I thought about what my options were and decided if I was going to stay in the Army, and after 1 year, they would send me back home from Vietnam, hopefully, I'd really be happier if I had a commission.
Mm-hmm.
With an opportunity to do other things. And so I went through more schooling on that and developed specialties.
And what is a commission?
Do you get to be a lieutenant or a captain, or you're not a sergeant or a private?
Okay.
So that's what a commission is.
Wonderful.
I had that and then started exploring what life should be in the Army. And for reasons I'm not entirely sure of now, I said, well, what sounds interesting is working with other armies as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I will see if I can apply and get accepted to be a Russian specialist. These were not good days in our relationship with Russia, but better than Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went off to almost 2 years of consecutive schooling, in which 1 year was entirely Russian language, and then the other year was understanding Russia and what's going on and how they fit in our world and so forth. And so I completed that and thought, this will be very interesting. Before very long, they notified me I was being assigned to Russia, to the U.S. Embassy, as an assistant military attaché.
So you were going to go to Russia?
I was going to go to Moscow. So I packed up my wife and family, and we took off for Moscow. I had been there once during my training for orientation, but now I was there full-time, and I was one of four Army attachés assigned to support the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
And found that career absolutely fascinating and enjoyed getting to know it. The first year I was there, actually the first 2 years I was there a total of just over 6 years. But the first 2 years I was there as an assistant Army attaché, our relations with the Russians were about as bad as they could be without going to war.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere my wife and I traveled, we were followed by security. Every room in our apartment that we lived in was wired, so we got to broadcast 24 hours a day continuously. And I got used to that after a while. But then I went home, and then they said, we need to send you back to Russia. My Russian was quite good, near native level,
mm-hmm.
so that made it a lot easier. And when I got back there, I decided that the relationship we had with Russia was not acceptable. Now, it's not normally a decision that I was a lieutenant colonel at this time, gets mm-hmm. to make, but I said, I'm going to change it. And the first thing I did, which had wonderfully positive results, is my wife and I were walking down the street of Moscow, as we frequently did, looking if there was new construction or activity or around military bases and new tanks on the street, anything. And I looked behind me, and about 20 yards behind was a Russian major walking, as there was always one 20 yards behind me, or sometimes 15. And I thought, this is just silly. And so I turned around and I went back to him, and he was scared to death. And I said, it's okay. You know what I'm doing here. I know what you're doing here. But there's no reason for you to be 20 yards behind me. Why don't you just come up here with us and we can talk while we walk?
That's wonderful.
And he thought, I'm probably going to be shot, he thought, but I'll do it. And he came up and walked with me, and we talked the rest of the time that this isn't relations how our nations ought to be. And
yeah.
So we talked like normal people about things going on. I didn't think anything more about it. I thought it was a good start.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, I got a phone call from a Russian general officer. I didn't normally get phone calls from Russian general officers as a lieutenant colonel.
Yeah.
But I did. And I said, what can I do for you? He said, that major you talked to yesterday works for me. I want to meet you too.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It was. We became very good friends. But he said, you're right, this is silly to be doing this.
Yeah.
So let's get together and talk about it. So now I had a Russian general that I was working with, as well as a fine major. And we developed a friendship and started to develop what I considered more normal relations. I was on my second two-year tour there. And I started visiting them, and he'd invite me out to his offices and sit there, and I'd go back to my office where the other attachés were. I said, Russian general just invited out to his office. He said, that never happened. I said, yes, it did.
Yeah.
He said, no, it can't. We've been here 3 years or so, and we've never done anything like that. I said, well, you ought to try. So anyway, I continued pursuing that, and he opened up some doors that I never could have gotten in otherwise. One of them was, he said, I have a good friend who is in charge of the Military Academy of the General Staff. That's our highest level school
mm-hmm.
that you can go to, and future generals all go there. And I'd like for you to come out and visit with us. I said, sure. I realized sometime later, I probably should have checked with Washington about doing all this, but I never did, because they would probably have said no, that I couldn't. So I just went ahead, I went out there, and I met with his group out there. And I said, you know, we really need to know each other a lot better than walking down the street behind each other. I'll tell you what, I will send you 4 blank invitations for your school, people in your school that are going to be generals, every month, and for them and their wives to come over to my house for dinner. And you fill in the blanks, because I don't care who comes.
Mm-hmm.
Just want people from your school to come over. And so we started doing that. And then I had people from his school each month come over with their wives, and we'd have a nice dinner that my wife prepared. And Pat was a big part of my story. My wife, she passed away this past June. But she would always jump in and help with anything. Her Russian wasn't very good, but I could interpret for her. So I would do that. And by this time, my Russian occasionally was mistaken for Russian.
Uh-huh.
But with them and their wives, since actually almost none of their officers spoke any English, and none of their wives did, that I could tell, we would do everything in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And that made them more comfortable as well. And we talked about issues and problems that they were facing and how they could deal with them, and sometimes how we could help them deal with them. And so at the end of that two-year tour, I had lots of friends in the Russian Army, and every time I would go to a different base, they'd run up and say hello. They didn't do that with any of my colleagues from the embassy.
Yeah.
So I thought this is a better way of going after it. And that helped a lot. And it also helped a lot in my communications back with the people in Washington about what they're thinking and what mm-hmm. their hopes are and so forth. The following each other down the street didn't improve communications much. And started doing that. And so soon after that, two things happened. One, because it had been successful, the Army promoted me to general officer and sent me back to Russia. So I went back there. And this time, I continued my relationship with the school out there. and tried to keep them involved with us. But my relationship with the senior command changed as well. Now, things were changing politically, and it was a little better than it had been when I started out there, but not that much better. And so I made friends with the Russian Minister of Defense and the Chief of the General Staff and most of their senior people. And my colleagues explained, we've never been to any of their offices, and I was getting invited on a regular basis.
Yeah.
To go out there and see them. I said, it's not that difficult. Just treat them like regular people.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen while I was there with my colleagues, and to the best of my knowledge, has virtually not happened since I left there. And so when I talked to people who are going to Moscow now and said, if you see the Minister of Defense, say hello, of course, for me. Said, we'll never see the Minister of Defense. I said, sure you can. And would talk to them about how to make these things go better. But it was extremely difficult because they came in with the mindset, we are still in conflict with each other, not physically, but politically, and we won't ever have any relationships with them. And to date, I have never successfully turned that around.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to my colleagues and who are over there now or have been recently and say, does the Chief of the General Staff approve of this kind of relationship? They said, well, we've never seen the Chief of the General Staff. How would we know?
Yeah.
I said, you ought to try to. Oh, no, that's not even possible. And I explained to them that when I was there, I did that routinely and developed what I thought was a good working relationship. There were things we could help them do. There were things they could help us with. It may have been a little unnatural that since we were still rivals in many ways that we could do that. But for instance, in ways it showed up, I was talking last year with one of my friends. I said, have you ever gone out to see the Chief of the General Staff? He said, they would never let us on his compound. I said, sure they would. He said, no, no one's ever done that. So I had a pass.
Yeah.
But they saluted me when I came in. I didn't have to ask if I could come in.
Yeah.
And they said, no, that never happened. I said, well, I was there, and I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
And we tried to work on ways to develop those relations. But my successors had either one or two problems. First, they didn't believe it was possible, so they wouldn't try it.
Mm-hmm.
Second was most of them did not have the language ability. As I said, I could carry on a conversation with Russians in Russian, and they thought they were talking to a Russian
mm-hmm.
intellectually because I used the same expressions and the same mm-hmm. jargon that they did. And since my friends in general did not want to pursue Russian that intensely.
Mm-hmm.
That was one blockade to it. The second is because of their attitude, in part, our relations with Russia are not much better than when I got over there the first time.
Yeah.
And we're still having hostile encounters with them when there's no reason. And the colleagues that I have sent over there, when they walk down the street, are followed 20 yards away by another major who's doing this thing,
mm-hmm.
and it saddens me greatly to see what has happened. And fortunately, in a way, for the people that I dealt with, it saddened them as well when they saw what relations could be.
Yeah.
And it didn't turn out that way for most of them. But I can still contact Russians, and they're happy to talk to me.
That's wonderful.
And my colleagues there now are telling me it's all impossible. So,
if you could give them advice, if you could give our administration or the people that are doing what you did previously any advice now, what would you say?
That the Russians have a very professional armed forces. They are intelligent. They are well educated. And if you can speak Russian as they do, you can do almost any kind of business with them that you would like to do. And the first part is developing a friendly relationship with them. Have them over to your house for dinner. I talked to someone just a few months ago said, have you ever had a Russian general over to your house for dinner? He said, no Russians ever come to my house.
Uh-huh.
I said, have you ever invited one? He said, well, no. I thought, well, that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah.
You can do it. But so we're back almost to where I started. So I keep thinking maybe I should go back there and start all over again.
Yeah.
And I don't know, because it worked for the people who were under me when I was a general over there. They would do what I was doing, but mm-hmm. once I left, they stopped doing that.
Yeah.
And that's just very sad experience for me in our relationships with Russia, because there are so many things that we could do together, places in the world that are having unrest and outbreak. If we were together, those things would be taken care of pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But I don't expect to see it. I just keep hoping something will happen.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you approached your time in any part of your life with a lot of kindness and understanding. And I think that it sounds like it made a big difference.
It did. It actually was awkward when I went to Vietnam. They were shooting at us, and that wasn't a very friendly relationship. But I signed up a couple months after I got there to teach in an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to make friends with their teachers and other people. And I never felt threatened going by myself to a Russian orphanage that somebody would try to shoot me or something like that.
Uh-huh.
To the best of my knowledge, they never did.
Yeah.
And that went away too when I left. Of course, the Vietnam War changed. And,
yeah.
But I don't know if it was just kindness or to me, it was just logic. If we're here, we've got choices. We can go to war with these people, or we can try to avoid war with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ought to do those things that tend to avoid war, like establish personal and friendly relationships with them.
And do you think that your time as a journalist and as an editor and building a business helped you understand the relationships you had later in life better? Do you think that
I wouldn't have said that. I think what I did learn as a journalist is you can have relations with people you disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a journalist, I didn't agree with all the politicians and so forth, but I could have a normal relationship with them.
Uh-huh.
And I sort of transitioned that, but since none of my subordinates had ever been journalists, I couldn't tell them to transition the same way.
Uh-huh.
And they wouldn't, even when they came over to my house and had dinner with the Russian generals, they wouldn't believe they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was, as I said, it was partially the language.
Mm-hmm.
That I could talk to a Russian for 20 minutes and he was not aware that he was speaking to an American, so that didn't bother him. If you haven't even taken the time to really learn their language, they have a little more trouble trusting you and believe that you're interested in their welfare as well as your own
mm-hmm.
on it.
And how did you learn Russian?
Initially, I went to the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California for 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing magic about that. Almost all of our specialists do that. But I knew I wanted to go to Russia, and so I probably took it a little more seriously than that I would sit there with a copy of one of their newspapers and tried to tell them what that was about.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got over there, at every opportunity, I would engage the Russians just like the major on the street.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have any business with him, but I thought, we can chat Russian and do that. And I'd go in the store, and if you start out speaking Russian, they'll answer you in Russian.
Uh-huh.
And so the more exercise you get in any skill, language specifically, the better you're going to get at it, and the more comfortable you'll be with it.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't have to think if I was speaking Russian or English.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they're speaking, I'll speak back to them.
Yeah.
Do that.
Do you think that you were able to instill in the people under your command the idea that other people have value and meaning because of your actions? You mentioned that they were very trepidatious about engaging other Russian commanders, but
well, they knew that none of the other Russian commanders spoke any English, So if you couldn't say it in Russian, you couldn't communicate effectively. And most of them, when they got over there, had only had 1 year of intensive language training, which wasn't enough. I was fortunate enough to get 3 years altogether because I kept asking for more schooling on it. And I knew I wanted to go to Russia. But despite the fact I ended up with a general, that is not necessarily career enhancing. Most of the people, I was in the Army, whether it's Navy or Air Force, we have all of them over there. They started out with, this is a one-time shot. I'll just stay out of trouble and try to do my best. And I knew that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my time in the Army. And so I approached it differently. But there's no special skill required to do that, just desire.
I would say you had a special skill. It sounds to me like you were and are a very caring person that had a lot of passion about what you were doing and trying to make the world a safer place.
It wasn't a natural language skill. I had taken earlier Latin and French and was not distinguished in either of them because I thought, when in the world am I going to talk to any Romans or others? Okay. What I had told Dawn is, if you will permit me, I'd like to say a few words about my wife.
I would love that.
She was very special to me from beginning to end. We met when I was a senior in college, and she was a junior out at Kansas State University.
What was her name?
Pat.
Pat.
Patricia Ann, but Pat was what she was. And I thought she was very attractive, and so I asked her out on a date. Her idea of a date was not what I had in mind at all, but I had dated a lot of girls in college, not so many in high school. And so she said, fine, we can have a date if you'll go watch my sorority sister play in a play at the campus theater. Wasn't an interesting topic for the play. It wasn't well done. But I was so impressed with this young lady that I was dating that I went home and I wrote in my journal, I'm going to marry her. I hadn't held her hand or kissed her yet. But I just knew that's what I was going to do. She had no idea at that point that I was thinking of that. But I continued pursuing her for the rest of that year, and then since she was a year behind me in school, to sustain my interest, I signed up for a year of graduate school so I could continue to convince her that that's what her future should hold. And then that in graduate school, we did get married, and I took her back to hometown newspaper. A couple of things that happened there. One is my younger brothers were growing up and they wanted to be involved. The other was that during one of my absences, my mother said, I really liked editing that newspaper. John, go find yourself some other work. Well, since I was in the Army, that was my other work. Couldn't quit that job when I didn't have another one. So continued doing that and had a good time in each of them. That I ended up as a general officer was a huge surprise to me because that had never been an ambition I had. I just tried to work with my soldiers, including my sergeants, the best you could and get the most out of them. And they seemed to appreciate that. And so I did end up getting promoted out of that. When I finished and I retired from the Army, the other thing I enjoyed doing most was going to school. I had at least two masters, maybe three, and a doctorate at that point, and had worked with our program on Russia at Harvard for a while. So they hired me at Harvard in an area I would never expect to be hired in necessarily, and that is we have in the Kennedy School, which is one of their schools. I think at the time about 15 PhD candidates here. Like for you to help them get through their doctorate. Now they were in 15 different areas, so I couldn't really help them substance-wise, but I would meet with them regularly and talk with them, how are you progressing, what are your next step in this, and when does that get you to actually writing the PhD and coaching them along the way. I found that very funny, since I'm sure they're all smarter than I was. It wouldn't have taken me as a PhD student at Harvard. But it worked for the school as well, because after 5 years, I guess, I notified them I'm going to retire from Harvard as well. And the head of the department called me and said, please don't, wouldn't you dare. Said, you've got plenty of it here. Don't worry about that. And after a couple weeks, he gave up, and I went ahead and retired.
How did you and Pat manage the times when you were overseas and she was not? Did you have children by that point?
I'm sure by the end of it we did. She was overseas with me in Moscow both the times I was there. The only other single one I had overseas outside of Vietnam was in Korea. And she couldn't be with me, so she was fully competent of running the house by herself and keeping children as they came along out of trouble. And all the children have grown up and now are parents themselves, so it's working out well.
How many years were you married?
54.
That's a great time.
No, should have been 100.
Yeah.
She passed very suddenly, and so it was more of a shock to me. Just a month before she passed away from was she had some dementia and then got a disease of some kind that the dementia attacked and started shutting her organs down. So the last night we had together was her telling me that she loved me and then dying. But I don't remember any fights in our life. And she was so amazingly flexible, because she thought she was marrying a newspaper editor and end up with an army officer.
It's quite a different life.
It was a very different life in very different places. We spent 10 years in Europe and 6 in Moscow. And I was off to every place, but Vietnam and Korea, she could go with me. And she did. And had an attitude that just made it so easy. I would come home and I said, I got new orders. She said, where are we going?
That's wonderful.
I thought it was. Made my life a lot simpler. And she would make friends. And like when I was having all the Russians over for dinner, she'd look up Russian recipes and fix meals for them. And I tried to get someone other than me occasionally to translate for her so she could be part of the conversation. And it all seemed to go very well.
Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I would love for you to do another interview. You have a lot of great stories, it sounds like.
Yes.
Is there anything you'd like to end with? Anything you'd like to say to someone that listened to this interview? Or any advice you'd like to leave for the world?
Well, the world's a little large. For people, my lesson to this, I think that the greatest problem that we create for ourselves in life is assuming that the way things are cannot be changed, and so nobody tries. And my experience with Russians said that didn't true at all.
Yeah.
It can be changed, anything.
Yeah.
We can become close friends. I'm still in touch with many of the friends I made in Moscow. And it just would irritate me so much when a subordinate would come in and say, I can't have them over for dinner. You know,
yeah.
Sure you can. It won't affect your security clearance. It won't do anything. You can go on living normally. You can treat them like normal people, and there's a good chance they'll treat you the same way.
That is excellent advice.
But it was hard to make that case with our relationship with Russia as it would be with China now.
Mm-hmm.
But I have never had any official dealings with the Chinese. I've dealt with the Koreans and others, but my impression is that they are born the same way we are. They are normal people.
Yeah.
And if you treat them normally, that's what you'll get in reciprocity.
Yes.
And I don't know why that's such a hard message to convey, except they've grown up in an atmosphere in which they've only known them as enemies.
Yeah.
Unless you want to keep them that way, there's no reason to continue treating them that way.
A little more humanity in our humanity.
Yes. Or just the recognition that the two of you could be reversed in life and you'd still be the same people.
Mm-hmm.
So just treat them like you would like them to treat you. And often it will happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, John. I've really appreciated your time. And I hope that people will listen to your words because they're very wise.
Thank you. I'm not sure that wisdom is one of my traits, but I go to school a lot, so...